Robert V.S. Reddick is the author of The Red Wolf Conspiracy, The Ruling Sea, and now The River of Shadows. Together with the final volume coming next year, these spellbinding novels make up the Chathrand Voyage Quartet, already being hailed as a classic of epic fantasy alongside the works of Philip Pullman, George R.R. Martin, and others. Before turning full-time to fiction, Robert was a theater reviewer and worked for the anti-poverty organization Oxfam. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you so much, Alan. I'm delighted to be here.
And we're glad to have you. Now, for the uninitiated, can you please give us just a synopsis of the story thus far, like they do with the huge scrolling text in the movies?
You bet. Although it's a bit of a challenge because we are at this stage, at the opening of The River of Shadows, a good 1,200 pages into what is essentially one story. And the books do have characters of their own, but there's quite a lot of backstory. So here it is in a nutshell. This is a story about a relatively small number of sea travelers on an extraordinarily large ship, five-masted, six-century-old sailing vessel. And it is the last of its kind. It is the survivor of a lost fleet. And they are on their way to a peace conference designed to end centuries of war between their empire and the enemy state, these being the two largest powers in this world of Alifros of mine. And en route, they discover that their own empire is up to some really dirty business, that in fact, their empire has no intention of signing a peace treaty, or rather of enacting a peace, but instead is seeking to throw the enemy state into a disastrous civil war, which will leave them so weakened that their own empire will be able to achieve the global victory that they've coveted for so long. That is the dilemma, and it's up to our heroes to decide how to respond to that. Now, in putting this conspiracy together, it is proven necessary to... For reasons I won't go into, to make a transnavigation of the globe. And what makes the Chathrand, this gigantic ship, an essential part of that plot is that by its sheer size, it is the last vessel left in the world that is capable of crossing what is called the Ruling Sea, this vast sundering ocean that separates the northern and southern hemispheres. So a good part of the structure of the story and of the adventures that have unfolded thus far is takes place in the course of that navigation. And where the River of Shadows opens up, the Chathrand has crossed the Ruling Sea, barely survived the crossing, 120-foot tall waves and so on, and immense challenges of nautical warfare kind, of magical kind, of thirst, of sickness, and everything imaginable has really happened to them by this point. And they have limped, weakened, but still afloat to the shores of the southern hemisphere and in a land that has essentially been forgotten in the north because, again, the two hemispheres have been cut off. So that is where the story reopens at the start of the River of Shadows. Now, because this is epic fantasy, things that have happened along the way have involved battles between transdimensional wizards and an outbreak of intelligence in certain animals of this world that caused them to suddenly develop human-like intelligence and often to go mad from the shock, and all sorts of other things. But the story is about halfway done at this point. And just to give one other detail, because I think it's essential to get a grasp of what all this is about, I should say that we experience most of this through the eyes of two young people, one Pazel Pat Kendall, who is he's not an orphan, but he is a boy without a country now because his country was annexed violently by one of the two empires in question a few years before the novel opens. Before the first novel opens. And his unlikely friend becomes a young woman named Sasha Isik, whose family is military elite in the same empire, and whose father indeed commanded the fleet that annexed and destroyed Pazel's homeland. So they don't have much reason to like each other, but they do join forces to start battling this conspiracy. And they are the heroes that we watch travel from young adulthood into something very different. And I'm truly thinking of them like child soldiers now because of the amount that they've been through.
Wow, that's fascinating, and it's quite a world. In fact, more like a universe that you have imagined there. As you were telling the story and setting that up, I was thinking, of course, about the Odyssey and about some of the more recent epics, even the Star Wars and others. But I'm curious, where did the inspiration for this series come from for you? What are your sources?
Well, it's always a multiple sort of answer. The initial image from which everything grew was a strange and quirky one. I was actually I was in Argentina, of all places. I did research towards a degree in tropical conservation and development, which I got in 1994. And I was in this remarkable place called Peninsula Valdez, about halfway down the Patagonian coast, and walking along some sea cliffs along the Atlantic early in the morning. And it was very foggy and very windy, really dramatic in every sense. And I just had a strange notion of what it would be like to experience a shipwreck there right in front of me. And I imagined this enormous vessel careening out of the fog and smashing into the rocks that I was looking at. And I didn't have any sense for why this image came to me so powerfully, but it was terrifying because I could hear the sound of all that violence of surf right below my feet. And was, you know, alone there, just able to contemplate this. And I began to think, now, that would be the end point in almost any story, but what would be truly fascinating would be to somehow trace the chain of cause and effect backwards through one step after another, maybe all the way back to the origin of the ship, or at least of the voyage, and to see how this disaster came about. So it started there, but, oh, so many things, from the first Gulf War to my own background, you know, marrying outside of my comfort zone, if you will. I'm married to a Marxist from India, and so there's many sources of inspiration. And what I love about writing a longer work is that you have a chance to put them all into the cauldron and let it steep and let it become something new. And I guess that's what's happened over the years.
Mm-hmm. And so are there any sources that you read as a young person, or either movies, books, literature, or did it really just come to you as this personal vision?
Oh, well, I've been such a reading addict all my life that I'm sure that the vision that I've put together has come from many sources, and I could acknowledge quite a few of them off the top of my head. I mean, certainly Moby Dick had a sense of had a part in it. The wonderful Earthsea books of Ursula K. Le Guin. Ursula Le Guin was a early mentor and still someone I admire immensely. Tolkien, of course, who, you know, is the touchstone for really most any epic fantasy writer. Even those who are writing against his tradition make, you know, we're all children of Tolkien in one sense or another. Really, the whole array of the classic legends. You mentioned the Odyssey, but I think of Ovid's Metamorphoses quite often, Metamorphoses. And then when I began to think about writing a book set on a sailing vessel, of course, I turned to Patrick O'Brien and C.S. Forster and many others who've just shown us all how it can be done and how good it can be over the years. So I had a immense learning curve with sailing itself, and I certainly took inspiration along the way, but I should acknowledge that I had to educate myself as well.
Well, thank you for
this business of running a ship with a crew of 500, or in case of my own, 800 people aboard.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing some of those sources. And so you mentioned Tolkien, and of course, a lot of the other series there have very passionate fans, and you yourself are very involved with your audience. What's your favorite way to engage with your fans?
You know, I'm finding that I really love and miss the cons, the conventions. I miss them when I'm not able to get to them because of the pace of the writing, which has been the case for the last 5 or 6 months. I haven't been able to attend one, but I am going to ReaderCon in Boston this July and can't wait for that. I had never been to anything like a con before writing this series, and they're wonderful inventions. I mean, in just the course of a few days, you can meet editors, writers, agents, illustrators, musicians, everyone under the sun who has, and of course, readers, the fans, in any quantity, in as much quantity as you have energy for. And I find that everyone tends to be respectful. There's a sort of organic understanding of how this can all work, and you know, the do's and don'ts. And I've been to really tiny ones, little boutique cons, like Vericon, the wonderful Harvard Student Association convention, and then enormous events like Comic-Con. And in all of them, you know, I don't see what's going on behind the scenes, and the organizing is tough, but the end result, for the writers at least, is wonderful access and also a lot of respect. I think we're shown a lively interest by the fans, and I get wonderful feedback there, one-on-one or in a panel setting. And I just think they're great. I mean, you'll hear sometimes people a little burned out on them. I suppose maybe in 20 years I might be as well, but right now I love them.
Mm-hmm. And you also have one or more websites and blogs. Do you keep up with those and also interact on social media?
I do indeed, yes. It's becoming, and I'm understanding that this is a evolving process. I have a great website, I think, with a lot of sort of extra goodies for the people who are really into the story. You can see a wonderful profile sketch of the Chathrand and a blow-up map of Alifrost, my world. And, oh, there's a pronunciation guide, which I think is pretty critical, since I have about 9 linguistic traditions that I try to keep distinct, and so I have very complicated names. And then, yes, I have a blog that I write things for as often as I can, and Facebook has evolved into a great way, too. All of this, of course, has to be kept in some sort of balance, because you could do, again, as much of it as you have energy for, and you can't let that become a substitute for getting the next book written.
And speaking of which, are you done with the fourth book? I believe it's titled Night of the Swarm. Is that right?
That's right, The Night of the Swarm. And no, I'm not done. I'm about a little over halfway, turning in a draft on September 1st. That's the plan. And having a blast. I think it's going to be something of a shock for me to be done telling this story at last. I've been at least taking notes on it and actively writing. Well, I've been taking notes since 2003, and I think I actually started to write it in 2005. So it's been with me a long time. And now that I'm rounding the last corner, it's going to be bittersweet. I mean, I'm overflowing with ideas for new things that I want to write. So in that sense, it's great that I'm getting near the end. But these have become real friends. I mean, even the villains I'm going to miss, to be honest. And once it's done, it's done. And this fourth book is the last one. It ends the story decisively.
Very good. And before we close, I did want to ask you, the audiobook series is narrated by Michael Page, and I understand you've heard some or most of those. What do you think of them?
I stand in awe of Michael Page, to be very frank. I love the audiobook format in general. I think it's, I've been enjoying that kind of storytelling since I was a little kid. I mean, the audiobooks of my childhood were just LPs that I would put on a record player with green and purple polka dots that my parents gave me, but I was spellbound by them at that age, and I've had variations on them as I've grown up. And now that I'm seeing my own books appear in audio form, I just love it. And I think that Michael Page has just done an astonishing job. I'd said at the outset that we see the experience the story through a relatively small number of characters, but the greater circle around these core characters is immense, and I'm sure that there are upwards of 60 voices that Michael will have had to do by the time he finishes the fourth book, maybe more. And he gives each one a distinct character, an unmistakable character, and he keeps them all straight, and I just find it wonderful. This very morning I had to take a drive, and I had book three on the CD player in the car. I was just given it a few days ago, and it's an astonishing work, and I think you have found a great actor who is recording this for you, and I'm just lucky to have him working on my project.
Well, thank you very much for that, and thank you for joining us, Robert Reddick, author of the Chathrand Voyage series.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.